for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. A tropical storm could push back efforts to permanently plug the broken PP oil well in the Gulf by at least another week. Workers out of a job for 6 months or more will resume getting unemployment benefits, and President Obama expressed regret to the former Agriculture Department official forced to resign over a misleading video. Joining me for the domestic hour of our Friday News Roundup, David Wilna of NPR, Gene Cummings of Politico, and Doyle McManus of the Los Angeles Times. You are an important part of the program, so I look forward to hearing your calls. Questions, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Let's talk first about Congressman Charlie Rangel. What led David Wilna to yesterday's unexpected announcement by the House Ethics Committee?
Well, we don't know exactly what the charges are that are going to be brought against Rangel, but we do know that he met with the committee in recent days. He was presented with their findings. They've been investigating this for almost 2 years, various charges against Rangel. And because he did not accept their findings, they're going to take it to a higher level. That is, they're going to adjudicate it. And that's going to happen possibly in September in a public hearing. We will only find out exactly what those charges are probably sometime next week, probably right before the House leaves on a 6.5-week break. So people can think about that over their August recess.
But, Gene, is there any chance that this could still be resolved without going to trial?
Well, there absolutely is, and I think that the announcement that the committee had found some reason to charge him with violations increases the chance that this will not go all the way to trial.
Why is that?
We are reporting at Politico suggests that they did, as David pointed out, they had been in negotiations with Rangel to find a way to reach a settlement in the case. And those negotiations weren't going very well. There was a sense by some committee members that Rangel was just trying to draw the process out and that he wasn't really prepared to negotiate and come to a real agreement. This turns up the heat on him to go ahead and go to the negotiating table and try to find some kind of resolution in which it could all go away, as opposed to having a show trial that could be quite messy and very detrimental for his party.
Doyle.
And that's exactly right. And that's because, in a sense, until now, Charlie Rangel's interests and the Democratic leadership's interests have been different. The Democratic leadership does not want a long trial going on camera or in public during the campaign season. Nancy Pelosi promised to clean out the House, and this is the Republicans' Exhibit A on where she fell short. You know, David said we don't know what the charges are, but we certainly know what the allegations were against Charlie Rangel, and there's plenty of evidence to back some of them up. And
the
biggest one is he has a condo in a yacht club in the Dominican Republic. He collected rental income from it, and the man who was in charge at the time of writing the tax laws said he never actually realized that he had to report foreign income. Well, that's really hard to believe. And then the other one, which may not be important nationally but drives New Yorkers nuts, is that Charlie Rangel was using 4 rent-subsidized apartments for office space. The rent subsidy system is to let people of modest income have access to rental housing, not for Charlie Rangel to have office space.
There's another pretty significant charge against him, and that's that he met with an oil company executive who was seeking half $1 billion in tax breaks, and he met with this businessman for breakfast the morning before his committee actually approved legislation that would give those tax breaks. This guy promised $1 million to a building that was being named after Rangel at a New York University. And that is now seen as also possibly one of the big charges being brought against him.
David Welton of NPR, Doyle McManus at the Los Angeles Times, Jean Cummings. She's Politico's assistant managing editor. And what happened in Washington this week is something we don't often hear, a genuine apology. Jean Cummings, tell us about Shirley Sherrod of the USDA.
Well, Shirley Sherrod is the ag official who was giving a speech at the NAACP, which was taped and then edited in a way by a conservative blogger to make it look as though she withheld support, or at least was inclined to withhold support from a white farmer for racist reasons.
How long ago did she give that speech?
It was
long time.
Yeah, it was months and months ago.
Years.
March, but she was referring to something that happened 24 years earlier.
I see.
Yes. And so it ended up being a two-minute clip that went up and got a lot of attention. And the White House, the news media, the NAACP, everyone overreacted to it without giving Mrs. Sherrod an opportunity to explain herself. And if they had done that, what they would have learned that the story she was telling actually was told the opposite of what the little clip implied. And that was in her case, in this case, years ago when this white farmer had come to her for help. She had gone through her own soul searching and realized that while she may have some instinctive racial feelings in those meetings, that she was wrong about that, and that he needed help just like every black farmer needed help, and that she actually overcame those feelings of prejudice in this incident and in this meeting, and she helped that farmer. So, in fact, her story was the complete reversal, and so the action in Washington then went on quick reversing.
It's interesting, Doyle, that USDA reacted to this story without watching the video, the whole video, without doing any investigation, simply taking that blogger's word for it, who had put this up and spread it all over the place. Why was there no further investigation?
Well, because in a way there seems to be a hypersensitivity in this administration about the race issue. There has been a politicization of race going on ever since, well, before Barack Obama became president, since he was, there's been a politicization of race in this country for 200 years in the broader sense. But oddly enough, this all happened almost 1 year to the day after President Obama's gaffe in a news conference about Skip Gates, the Harvard professor who got into a tussle with the Cambridge police. There are issues of race that when they come up, this administration sort of goes into a freeze and doesn't deal with them gracefully, which is odd because it's worked very hard to be a post-racial administration. What happened here was the Agricultural Department, Tom Vilsack, the secretary, decided that this was going to be sort of on the spur of the moment, this was going to be a terrible hit. They could not afford to look as if reverse racism had been going on. There had been earlier cases where the administration was accused of reverse racism, including one that's very popular on Fox News, an accusation that Eric Holder, the attorney general, has laid down a policy of not prosecuting black defendants in certain cases where the victim is white. And so it was a very bad hair trigger misjudgment.
What got to me was, why didn't they consider the source before they picked up the phone and fired Shirley Sherrod?
Right. I think that in hindsight, of course, is what everyone should have done, and many people have acknowledged that. But as well said, the hair trigger response that you had here was partly related to, at least Ms. Sherrod says that she was told that she had to resign because they were going to put this video on the Glenn Beck show that evening. And so they wanted to do something before then. And you can see this very defensive posture of the Obama administration. They want to knock down everything that can be used as an argument that you know, a black presidency is somehow payback for all of the racial injustices of the past. And it probably was an overreaction, kind of a parable about a parable.
But let's talk about the source, Gene.
Andrew Breitbart, who is the blogger who put it up, he is a conservative activist. He is a great ally of the Tea Party movement. He has been using a variety of tactics, questionable tactics, to try to attack institutions on the left.
He was involved in the Acorn situation.
He was the one who gave great display to the so-called hookers and the hooker and the pimp who went into the Acorn headquarters. And basically they brought Acorn to its knees with that publicity and with that you know, sort of undercover journalism, as they seem to call it. Which...
Okay, I want to read to you the words of Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post yesterday to get your reaction. He wrote, "After the Shirley Sherrod episode, there's no longer any need to mince words. A cynical right-wing propaganda machine is peddling the poisonous fiction that when African Americans or other minorities reach positions of power, they seek some kind of revenge against whites." Doyle?
Well, that's exactly right. That is a line of argument that has been used since the Obama campaign by the right. They have, by some on the right. This is, I'm sorry, I should make it clear. This is really a very small group of people on the right, but it's a very powerful and poisonous charge that flies around the world before anyone gets a chance, before, as we say, before truth straps its boots on.
Doyle McManus of the Los Angeles Times. We'll take a short break and right back. And just as a postscript to that Shirley Sherrod story, David Wellner, what kind of a job has Shirley Sherrod been offered?
She's been offered a job with the Ag Department in charge of improving race relations. And you know, what an incredible irony, this woman who was forced to pull over to the side of the road and told to resign immediately because of racially insensitive remarks, allegedly, is now the person who's being offered the job to improve race relations.
And the president said this morning on Good Morning America, I guess it was yesterday, sorry, he said, "I've told my team," after he said that Agriculture Secretary Vilsack jumped the gun, "partly because we now live in this media culture where something goes up on YouTube or a blog, everybody scrambles. I've told my team, told my agencies, we have to make sure we're focusing on doing the right thing instead of what looks to be politically necessary at that very moment." Teachable moment, Doyle.
One of the things we all ought to learn from this is that the media environment has changed a lot. I know we've known that for a long time, but here's a case in which sort of old media reflexes kicked in. Something goes up, it looks plausible, it's on video. Well, it's probably true. But there is this proliferation of, I wouldn't call them journalists, I'd call them polemicists and propagandists who set out to make a point, and massage the facts into it. It's not a new phenomenon. This has occurred throughout the entire 20th century. It's been a case on the right and on the left, but you can't look at something on the internet and assume it's truthful.
I think that, you know, the president says he's talked to his administration and all his officials about this, but, you know, the media blew this, but the White House blew this bad too. And for all of their talk about how they're going to stay above the fray and they're not driven by the 24-hour schedule and, you know, the grown-ups have come to Washington, I think that this incident shows that, in fact, they aren't many of those things. They are very hyperly attached to some of the cable news, to the news cycle. And I think fixing it is not going to be as easy as just having a conversation with everybody and asking them to do due diligence before you turn around and fire somebody. The very idea that the president has to send that message to anyone is a little disturbing. Why weren't they doing due diligence anyway?
Okay, and clearly we could spend the entire hour on this. Every single caller wants to talk about this. I've already got a stack of emails on it. We're going to move on. President Obama signed a jobless benefits bill. Doyle, what's in that bill and how long will those benefits keep going?
Well, that bill basically extends unemployment insurance again for another 6 months. It takes eligibility for unemployment insurance up to 99 weeks, which is a modern record, but it's an appropriate record because the most horrifying thing about this recession isn't its length. It's not yet the longest recession we've ever had. In fact, technically, we're slowly coming out of the recession. It isn't even the height of the unemployment figure, because that was higher in the Reagan recession. What has marked this one out as especially painful is long-term unemployment. The average length of unemployment right now is about half a year. That's double the previous record, which was in that Reagan-era 1980s recession. And that's very, very tough on people, because the longer your unemployment goes, not only do you take a deeper financial hit in your family, but the harder it is to get your next job.
So the bill finally passed. Why was it so contentious, David?
Well, it's interesting, the story of what's happened in Congress with extending these unemployment benefits, which are provided to people after they've received unemployment from their states for half a year. Then the federal government takes over. And in the past, this has been something that's been done routinely. It has not really been that much of a partisan issue. Almost always it's been paid for by borrowing, incurring deficits in both Republican and Democratic administrations. So last February, when this program was expiring, the Senate tried to have a temporary extension of it. And Senator Jim Bunning, a Republican from Kentucky, got up and said, "I object." And even some of his Republican colleagues were sort of stunned that he would try to make a stand on fiscal rectitude over an issue like this, which was about helping people who were in desperate straits. And many of the Republicans, when it finally came to a vote to end his filibuster on this, voted with Democrats on that initial vote. But as the weeks went by, you saw more and more Republicans coming over to Bunning's side. And so by the time these benefits ran out at the beginning of June, and Democrats were trying to have a six-month extension of this, they ran into a wall of opposition from Republicans, except for the two Republican senators from Maine. That was not quite enough to get them to the 60 they needed, because Robert Byrd died in June, and so they were one short. So, you know, it was finally resolved because a replacement was sworn in for Byrd on Monday and on Tuesday, I'm sorry. And that gave them the 60th vote. But it was the kind of a fight that I think Democrats really didn't see coming. But in fact, it's gone on for almost 5 months now.
It's fascinating to me how one party or another can change the subject. This was about unemployment. Republicans made it about the deficit.
Absolutely, and that was their goal. And this is just the first of many of these ideological fights that we're going to see in the next few months, because both the Democrats and the Republicans right now are trying to figure out, stake out a certain number of issues that they're going to try to get onto the House floor or get onto the Senate floor to force votes in order to get score points for the election. We're going to be having these kinds of ideological fights now right through to November, because the Republicans now see they have an opportunity, and everybody's in war mode right now.
And the point is that these run out as of when? December?
Well, let's see. Yes, that's right. They run out at the end of the year, and we're going to have this fight all over
all
again.
Perhaps a different count in the House. We don't know. But in any case, after the election, let's talk about the Gulf and why the cleanup there is moving so slowly. There are people who are arguing that the federal government is resisting moving as quickly as it could by virtue of regulations like EPA, resisting bringing in foreign elements that could help out. What's going on here? Are we dealing with a bureaucracy?
No, I don't think so. I think it's much more complicated than that. I think it's been, politically useful for the Louisiana governor, Bobby Jindal, to point the finger at the feds and blame them. But I think that the issues, if you'd go deeper, are far more complicated. Yes, there has been foreign aid offered. But when you hear from Thad Allen, the U.S. Coast Guard commander who's overseeing everything, he said, some of the things that are being offered we don't really need, or some of the things that are being offered may not get there in an efficient way. So they're making judgments as they go along. And the matter, the other area of a big fight is whether these earthen sand burns that they're building to create a perimeter around the Louisiana marshlands of sand and rock, whether they are going to be effective, whether they can be put up fast enough, whether they might do more harm than good. There's great debate about what will happen to the ecosystem as these are being built. And it's not just a debate between the federal government and the state government. It's between the scientific community and the environmentalists. And so these are complex issues. And there is also evidence that Bobby Jindal down in Louisiana hasn't used all of the federal aid that has been offered to him.
Interesting.
And so it's a much more complicated fight than what people might believe, but it is a wonderful political point for the Louisiana governor.
Now, Gene is absolutely right, and just one more note on the berms. There's not really much of a debate in the scientific community about those berms. Scientists say they're a lousy idea. They're enormous. They're expensive. They could do more damage long-term to the shoreline. If anyone who's looked at the question of beaches on the East Coast, for example, knows what happens when you start messing around with tides and flows on beaches. But Governor Jindal loves them because they're huge and they're visible. They are visible evidence that your state government is doing something about this. So it's a kind of a perfect collision of political interests and scientific judgment.
And those berms sort of carry his signature because they're the idea that he's pushed. But this puts Republican governors in a very interesting spot. They've spoken out against big government and federal intervention and so on. And yet, once again, just as during Katrina, they're looking to the federal government to bail them out here. And it's leading to a certain amount of cognitive dissonance, I think, in the Gulf.
And I think the Mississippi governor, Haley Barbour, has struck a different tone, which I think is more consistent with Republican ideology. And we'll see how long term each one of them plays out. Because Barbour has basically said, I think the feds are doing a pretty good job. It was pretty much what he said in Katrina, that he thought the feds were doing the best they could. He has said pretty much the same about the Obama administration. He's been very consistent. Mm. And if you look back at the long recoveries from any kind of natural disaster or man-made disaster in this case, Jindal's raising expectations here about what those burns are going to do and that sort of thing. And that may work now, but let's see 3-4 months from now when we see the true impact of that.
All right, and let's talk about the signing of the financial overhaul bill this week. What difference is it really going to make, Doyle?
Well, we're not going to know immediately on the big things. I mean, the two biggest thing that bill does is, one, it raises capital requirements for banks and other institutions, but that takes 5 years to do. And the other is it sets up a very complex structure to try and avoid a financial collapse like the one that sunk the economy a couple of years ago. Well, we're not going to know whether that's going to work until we face another financial collapse. So here are the two things we're going to see right away. One is new credit card fees, oddly enough, because the banks have been prohibited from whacking you on your overdrafts and some other things. So they're finding other ways to nick you. So watch your credit card bill to see if they ask you for an annual fee that's bigger or that wasn't there before. And then the second thing I'm happy to say is a big boost to the Washington, D.C. regional economy, because lots and lots of lobbyists are going to get lots and lots of business because there are going to be lots and lots of regulations to write here.
Doyle McManus, The Los Angeles Times. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And why the opposition to the appointment of Elizabeth Warren to head the newly created Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection?
Well, David. I think Elizabeth Warren is seen by corporate America as being their archenemy. She has been a very outspoken consumer advocate. She's done a lot of work in bankruptcy, trying to protect people against more draconian bankruptcy laws. And this Consumer Protection Bureau was her brainchild. And I think that there's a certain apprehension among people in business that she would really go after them as the head of that agency. She, you know, since it's a new agency, she would have a lot of say in how that agency is shaped and really put her stamp on it. And I think for that reason, it's not as if they're finding a replacement for the head of that agency. It really is sort of who is going to make a mark on that agency. And I think there's a lot of resistance in Congress, among Republicans especially, and I think in the Senate, it would be a gigantic fight to get her confirmed.
Interesting that there were rumors that Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner did not want her. We asked Senator Dodd about that on the air last week. He said it would be hard. It could be difficult for her to be confirmed. And then yesterday, Timothy Geithner said he thought she'd be wonderful at the job.
Well, maybe Geithner doesn't want to actually put his neck out too far because the left is mobilizing behind her. But David used the word apprehension in the business community. I think abhorrence might be a better word. They don't want
her. Because she's tough.
She is. And, you know, she hasn't just rattled the nerves of the business community and Republicans. I think that there are elements in the Treasury Department and in certainly the Fed that don't want her kind of style around and would have some objections to her. She's very
consumers need that kind of toughness after everything they've been through. Why not Elizabeth Warren?
Well, that's a question that Congress, you know, well, the administration will answer when they make the appointment. Do they want to bring in somebody who will be a very strong advocate in her style? They may choose someone else. Because Elizabeth Warren has fought the good fight, but she has made a lot of enemies along the way, and they may choose to bring in a fresher face.
But the larger political context here is that the Obama administration is under attack from Republicans, from the Chamber of Commerce, and from others who are asserting that this administration is anti-business, that it's passed this big financial regulation law with regulations we don't know about, that it's putting this tough woman from Harvard into this job and she's going to crack down, that businessmen won't hire people. Here's the tough political charge, that businessmen are not hiring because they're afraid of more taxes, more regulations, and they don't know what the business environment is going to be like. Now, most economists are saying, no, actually, that may be true at the margins, but the main reason businessmen aren't hiring is that business is lousy and they'd love to be hiring. But it's a very stinging political charge, and the administration is scrambling to try and erase that anti-business line of argument.
Republicans call this job-killing legislation. And one other thing about the Consumer Protection Agency, agency. Most Republicans were never behind creating
that
such an agency in the first place, much less putting Elizabeth Warren in charge of it.
But as you said, Jean, she's got a lot of backing from the left.
Well, this is a real problem for the administration because if you look at the kind of appointments that Obama has made, Elizabeth Warren doesn't really fall into the category. She is strong-willed. She is very out there. There are no illusions with her. There's no like soft center with her. That's not the kind of appointment Obama has made. But now the left is mobilizing. He could end up yet again butting up against his own party base when he tries to make this choice.
Jean Cumming, she's Politico's assistant managing editor. We'll take just a short break. When we come back, time to open the phones.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. And by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. Mixed messages from Britain on its military commitment to Afghanistan. The U.S. announces a new aid package to Pakistan. And Syria bans face veils at its universities. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back to the domestic hour of our Friday News Roundup this week with David Wilna, congressional correspondent for NPR, Doyle McManus, columnist for the Los Angeles Times, and Jean Cumming. She's assistant managing editor for Politico. And we're going to open the phones now. First to Melbourne, Florida, and to Eric. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane, and thank you for having me.
Sure.
Diane, I was going to comment on the clip that was shown and led to the dismissal. I believe what is important is the message within that message, and that race is more of a wedge issue. If we had a chance to listen to the entire video, we could hear that this is not a speech about race, but more so about the haves and have-nots.
Yes.
And if I may, it seems to have weaved in well with the entire three issues that we've discussed. I think that in this case, over this period of time, we've seen the wealth aggregate within the hands of a select few, and that we've seen the disparity grow. And it ties in with such advocates as Howard Zinn and A People's History of America, but also when we look at the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., and one of his statements was, "We can't be a first-class nation with second-class citizenry."
Well, that is certainly the case. Any comments?
Eric, one thing that was interesting this past week, not related to the firing of Ms. Sherrod, but it had to do with unemployment benefits extension. And in that debate, Republicans were saying we can't put a $34 billion hole in our budget. And Democrats were coming back and saying, well, but wait a minute, you're the same people who want to extend the Bush tax cuts for the top income bracket beyond this year and over the next decade, that would cost $700 billion. Why is it that you're advocating for the wealthy in this case? And you get the sense of a growing, a brewing kind of class warfare conflict coming up here.
All right. Thanks for your call, Eric. Let's here's an email from Kerry in Cincinnati, which he titles Slander. He says, "Has anyone from Fox apologized to Shirley? How about the right condemning the perpetrator of this hoax, Doyle?"
Well, actually, Fox was not the perpetrator, and Fox, believe it or not, appears to have behaved fairly responsibly. They actually produced a memo from inside Fox that said, wait a minute, before we make a big deal out of this, let's watch the whole videotape and make sure we know what we're doing. Oddly enough, the administration acted not because of something Fox aired, but because of its fear of something that Fox might air. But to go to Kerry's main point, absolutely, the perpetrator, who's Andrew Breitbart, ought to be condemned, has been condemned, and there might be the grounds for some kind of defamation case against him for spreading a report if he knew that it was false.
I think that Fox was more mixed than that. I think Bill O'Reilly did apologize. Sean Hannity didn't. Glenn Beck raised some flags about the Andrew Breitbart and the tape itself. I think Fox was a little all over the map. Clearly, they were the ones who were hyping the little clip the first day. But I feel like the entire news media failed on this. And, you know, we single them out because they aired it repeatedly on some of their shows, not on all of their shows. But the rest of us failed, too. The rest of us didn't, you know, you didn't see the whole speech over on MSNBC.
Right.
You didn't see the whole speech on CNN. And you didn't see Politico, you know, come in with our article that refuted the message of it until it was too late. And so I think all of us have egg on our face.
Well, CNN, to its credit, actually found the farmer who had been helped by Ms. Sherrod and spoke with him the next morning. And in that conversation, he said that in fact, she had helped him save his farm. And at that point, I think it became clear that there was probably more to that video than what
Precisely.
People had seen.
All right, to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Jeff. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I think in this context, I mean, it's been going on for decades, of course, but we can't lose sight of the fact that the NAACP also performed an incredibly cynical and frankly, a little bit dishonest move when they passed this resolution about the Tea Party. Yes, I know they said the Tea Party needs to take out or to condemn racist elements, and they didn't say that the Tea Party was racist. And I also know that after the resolution, one person in California, I think, wrote a parody and was subsequently removed. However, you know, one has to look at how cynical this act of the NAACP was. Imagine if a Republican caucus came out and said the NAACP needs to remove racist elements from its organization. I don't think for one second that would not be deemed to be an attack on the organization as a whole, or the implication that the organization itself is racist.
That actually is the very point that Andrew Breitbart claims he was trying to make, in that he claims his motivation was to defend the Tea Partiers against the NAACP's comments, in which the NAACP did say that the Tea Partiers had elements of racism within their ranks. They specifically did not say that the Tea Party movement as a whole is a racist organization. They were very careful to differentiate between the two. But what Breitbart claims is that he then wanted to illustrate that there were, quote, quote, racist elements inside the NAACP. And that's why he seized on her speech and edited it in a horrible, horrible way.
I should say. All right, to Miami, Florida. Orly, thanks for joining us. Orly, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go right ahead, please.
Thank you so much. I love your show. Thank you for having me. I hope that I can get this question out clearly. I understood from Ben Bernanke's statement that one of the reasons this recession is so long in hanging on is that small businesses are having a very difficult time getting any kind of credit. And I can speak for that. I have a small business in Miami, Florida. Sterling Credit have been in business for over 10 years and have suffered from the recession, of course, because I'm in hospitality, have not been able to get any loans. And I have some independent contractors that work for me that have recently filed for unemployment claims. And all of a sudden, I have been told that these people are not independent contractors, that they're employees, and now I'm being investigated, you know, for having them be employees instead of independent contractors when that was never the issue. There's a set of criteria for the IRS, another set of criteria for the county where I am licensed, and another set of criteria for unemployment.
All right. David.
Well, I think the point about that it's hard for small business to get credit is one that was actually being debated furiously last night on the floor of the Senate, because there is a bill there that there's an amendment actually sponsored by one of your Florida senators, George Lemieux, which would make $30 billion available to community banks to lend to small businesses. This would be optional for them. And they say that this will actually end up making money for the Treasury. And there was strong Republican opposition, but they actually did manage to get past a filibuster on it. So that may be on its way.
All right. Here's an email from John in Ann Arbor, Michigan, listening on WUOM. He says, why do your guests continue to push the narrative that the administration is to blame rather than the fact that Fox News ran this video endlessly? Also, you continue to claim this happens on both sides. Please give me an example of the left wing doing something like this. Jean?
Well, I'll go first because I think I'm the one who said that the administration has to take some responsibility for this. And here's why I say it. You know, they're as cynical as we all become, there's a right and there's a wrong. And Shirley Sherrod was done wrong. And it's just that simple. And there were a lot of people who did wrong to her. It began, perhaps, with Andrew Breitbart
Not
and Fox.
Perhaps. It began.
It began.
Right.
The rest of the media failed her, except in maybe a few instances. And the administration failed her.
All right.
She got fired. And Andrew Breitbart and Fox couldn't fire her. That was a decision made by the administration. And they didn't do due diligence before they fired her.
All right.
So they carry that responsibility.
Is there an example on the left that any of you can think of where this kind of exposure of an edited statement or video occurred, was used repeatedly, and somebody lost their job because of a lie?
Well, I think there was a case a few years back during the 2004 presidential campaign, CBS then CBS News anchor Dan Rather was involved in a segment reporting on George W. Bush's military service, and he had given credibility to documents that were later questioned that seemed to show that he got this gig down in Texas because of his family connections, and in the end rather ended up
resigning,
losing his job over it.
Yeah, if we want to peel back all of the pages of history, sure, we can go back. There was, for example, years before that, a CNN report about the purported use by American forces of chemical weapons in Southeast Asia that turned out to be groundless at the time because it was based on documents that fell apart. There may have been something there, but that report was corrupt as a piece of journalism at its core, and CNN eventually ended up apologizing for it. But look, that's so, you know, has stuff happened? Has, you know, are unfair things said on left and right? Of course they are. What is unique about this case, let's not mix things up, is that the news cycle has sped up so much that for the first time that I think any of us can remember, an administration, there's some dispute over whether the White House reacted or just the Agriculture Department, but an administration reacted to something, felt it had to react before even taking 24 hours to check it out. And I think that's why we're pointing a finger at the administration.
Before taking 1 hour, they took no time. The NAACP condemned Shirley Sherrod, and they had her tape. They had the speech. They didn't look at it.
Gene Cummings at Politico, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And now to Tampa, Florida. Good morning, Chris. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, ma'am. Actually, to respond to the last question, I'm an ardent Democrat, but just to be objective, Michael Moore's guilty of selective editing. Though it seems like Fahrenheit 9/11 didn't actually perpetuate anything or come to the conclusion that the most recent thing with the NAACP did with any firings. But actually, I wanted to call in. I come from the business community, and just listening to all of the chatter from, I hate to use terms like this, but right-wing people, especially in support of the business community, where they say that we need unregulated markets, where we need unregulated business so that business can do what business is supposed to do. But there just seems to be a logical disconnect, and I see this all the time in my own business, where people just perpetually lobby for laws and regulations that favor themselves and make them almost immune to any sort of repercussions to their actions. So with someone like Elizabeth Warren, I was just curious, why shouldn't consumers have somebody that's going to fight as hard for them as businesses do to keep themselves out of harm's way?
And that's exactly the question I was asking, Gene.
Well, that's certainly the argument that her supporters are making, is that you do need someone fired up, tough, and in your face to go up against the huge lobbying block that is the business community. Those who are, and it's for that reason the business community doesn't want her. There are people in the middle who have, they look at Elizabeth Warren and think, how do you get stuff done in Washington? And the way you get stuff done in Washington is through negotiation and compromise. Will she be that person? In other words, will she be someone who can actually get something done or someone who can give voice to the consumers? And there could be a big difference between the two.
And finally, to Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio. Hi, Richard, you're on the air.
Good morning, Ms. Rehm. Good morning to the panel.
Morning, sir.
To some extent, I feel like
I'm going to have to ask you to make your question a brief one. We're almost out of time.
Certainly. Can anyone on the panel tell me what their news organization is going to do in response to what happened with the Shirley Sherrod event?
I think that's an excellent question. Let's start with you, David.
Well, I know that NPR has had several stories about this, and we also have a couple talk shows that have looked at this. And I'm sure that this is going to be the talk of the town for some days to come. And it's the kind of story that is rich in possibilities for exploring all kinds of questions that are out there. But I think it's really touched a nerve in this country. And that's what news organizations are for. We're here to shine light on questions and to get people talking about these
things. We all need to do a better job. And that's what it comes down to. Doyle McManus of the L.A. Times, Gene Cummings of Politico, and David Wilner of NPR. I want to let you know I'll be on vacation starting Monday, and I'll be back with you on Thursday, August 12th. I'll miss you all, but I'm looking forward to my vacation. You take care. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.